Welcome to Inclusionism. It's Sunday. It's 5:34 in the p.m. I'm your host, James Felton Keith. And we're here for another Sunday on our show where we like to talk about exclusion primarily and how we remedy the ills of it. This is the show where we like to say individuals are at their best when they identify with the community, and communities are only at their best when they identify all of their individuals. This week, we're going to get nerdy and tumble way, way down the rabbit hole with Sean Rochester. He's the author of The Black Tax. Everyone should have a copy of this book. I'm going to send it to everybody for, well, the holidays are over, but whenever I get a chance to send people something, I'm going to be sending this book. You can find it online on social media at Black Taxed with an ED at the end, everywhere. Or just look up Sean, that's S-H-A-W-N. He is a Chicago Booth MBA. He's a corporate star. We actually had the chance to meet recently at 100 Black Men event, but I've had his book for, I think, nearly a year, and his name regularly comes up in circles where we're talking about equity and payments and business with regards to what has been stolen and what has been missed in the Black community, especially over the course of the past 150 years or, per Reconstruction. So with that said, I don't want to run on too much because Sean has a whole lot to say, and I'm hoping that we can do this multiple times. Thank you for coming all the way to Harlem. Where are you coming from today?
I'm actually coming in from New Haven.
From New Haven.
Yeah.
The
kids had a track meet there.
Yeah.
They did really well.
So two kids.
Two kids.
One wife.
Yeah.
I'm kidding.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So two kids and a wife. A dog was a boy and a girl.
Yeah.
And
a son and daughter.
No pets?
We just got a dog.
Oh, really?
Like two and a half months ago.
That is, like, ideal. You got the whole thing.
Yeah, we got the whole, we just need that picket fence.
I was going to say, is the garage like a two-car thing with all of that stuff going up?
It's...
all the stuff.
Yeah, it fits the bill.
I'm with it. Well, thank you. I was in Brantford, Connecticut for a second, and I used to make that two-hour train ride from New Haven regularly, working in the city. My fiance at the time, she wanted to live out there. She worked on Plum Island.
Mm-hmm.
And, we've since broken up just like a decade ago. But she was like, I think we can move close to New Haven. We thought it would be fun. We're out in the middle of nowhere in Brantford. But that train ride used to be grueling because I was over here every day. So, again, thank you for coming. As we get into this book, man, so everyone in our circles, I think, everyone in my circles is definitely talking about this book. They reference it in casual conversation.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk about sort of the trillions that are missing. I mean, you have to read this book. I mean, there are tens to nearly $100 trillion that Sean has X'd out in this particular book that Black folks are missing, and as a result, we can't sort of build on. So before we get into the book and the contents of the book and where it's going, sort of as a professional who I'm assuming didn't necessarily need to write much, what brought you here? What made you, what got you here?
Yeah, so
it's, what inspired you? What made you angry? I don't know. Yeah.
There are a number of things. one of the things is if when you think about the position, that we are in economically, mm-hmm. and the ramifications of that.
We being black folks. Okay, yep.
That's just never made sense to me. Mm. I've always felt like, what we see in our communities is not who we are. It is more like, when you go to a fun house, mm-hmm. and you see those mirrors and they're all distorted and the reflection is a distortion of who you truly are, mm. right? And one of the things I wanted to do kind of after my career, I started down the path of, this is a long story, but I'm going to try to make it short.
No, go. We got a whole hour. This is the long story show. We go real way down the rabbit hole.
But. So the first thing I wanted to do was actually kind of tackle the issue of the wealth gap and really deal with the fact that, you know, we're missing a critical mass of knowledge because of this traumatic history that we've been through about how to manage our limited resources. So I kind of started down that path, ensuring people just how to manage their resources in a powerful and transformative way. Mm. And then after you go through that journey and you come out the other side and you're transformed, it was then to advocate for us doing business with Black enterprise, like all of us, right?
Sure.
Black people plus other people.
Mm-hmm.
Because it has a massive stimulative effect on demand for our products and services that stimulates hiring, so on and so forth. And, you know, what one of the things that you learn over time is you don't just lead with, like, hey, you should do business with Black business, because a lot of people don't want to, despite the things that they say. If you look at the numbers, about 2% of our gross total spend is on Black enterprise, so 98% isn't.
Black and other people don't want to do business with.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it was like how to get us really thinking about that in a different way, because very often people feel like this lower quality that they have to be concerned with. They feel like, you know, products and services from other groups are just kind of better, right? And they have all kinds of experiences that they will use to kind of back up this thought process.
Sure.
So when you think about it, you know, a lot of times when we interface with our enterprises, it's either from a charitable standpoint, I'm going to help you out, right? Or it's as if it's a cost. You know what I mean? Like, I'm going to take the bullet and kind of and work with a Black business.
Mm-hmm.
And my view is if you interpret it as a cost, well, let me show you what the real cost is, right? And that kind of got me down this path of looking at, you know, the financial cost of discrimination. Now, I don't, you probably recall over time, every 6 months or so, there's some study that comes out and there's some article that's written that talks about how Black people are being discriminated in a particular industry.
Yeah.
And I would see that over a number of years. And that always seemed like it was a tax to me. Right? You know, you see it in a house.
I didn't think about it that way. Okay.
Because it's a cost.
Sure.
Right? It's actually a very nefarious, it's the worst tax possible because you actually don't benefit from it. Right?
Right. Well, yes, it can be progressive in any way. Yeah. Or regret. Yeah.
So tax, you know, people.
Yeah.
So it's a very nefarious tax
because
other people benefit from it, but not you. So, you know, I started down a path of, let me kind of aggregate those things and really kind of take a look at that. And I started just looking at the present and the markets that are really critical for wealth accumulation. Mm. The costs are pretty astounding. And then you get this question, like, where did this come from? Like, was this always the case?
Yeah.
And then I started to look at what I call the historical tax. Just go back over time from the period of slavery and just kind of walk through till now. And that's kind of like pulling at a sweater. We'll talk a little bit more about that. But once you see that string and you start pulling and researching, you start to see more and more that's uncovered. And then it was about, you know, how do I convey that information to people in a powerful, potent, transformative way? And then kind of lay out a framework, a set of actions that we can take to start to bend this trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And you know, the process of doing the research was just, it's harrowing. There's a lot of.
About how long did that process take? Like, when would you say this started? The actual research of building on, of pulling at the sweater.
Yeah.
Of,
it evolved over a couple years.
Yeah.
But the last 10 months or so.
Yeah.
Was pretty much, you know, all day, every day, because
day,
I wrote two books at the same time.
Yeah.
And then I created like an online series and a bunch of different things all at the same time.
At The Good Shepherd, is it The Good Shepherd or The Good Steward? .org.
Yeah. So to get the book, they can go to www.blacktaxed.com.
Okay.
For sure. And then, you know, the company is called Good Steward LLC. So we're just trying to make sure that we can be good stewards of our resources.
Yeah.
So, I wrote this book plus a book about financial management, personal financial management, at the same time.
Okay, so the name of the firm, okay, is The Good Steward, but everything is at the Black Tax. There's nothing else that we need to go and check out from an advisory standpoint.
You can just go there, and then people can reach out to me. Yeah.
Okay.
Afterwards.
All right. This is, you know, book number what? 2 in a potentially 4 book series.
Well, this was supposed to be the second book.
right.
of two that was created. Right. You can go on and do many more.
Sure.
But with kind of the change in administration and all of this kind
what
of...
What administration?
The current administration. From Obama.
The president.
Yeah,
okay.
This one.
Yep.
You start to see a lot of just, you know, kind of vitriolic language and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of, you know, racialized expressions, right?
Sure.
Of all these kind of deep-seated feelings. And I thought it was really important that people kind of understand some context.
Sure.
Right? Particularly when whatever they feel relates to, like, black people.
Sure.
And the experience here. So that was released first.
Okay.
And then we'll release it's called CPR for the Soul.
Right.
We'll release that in a couple months.
I like it. Okay. All right. So, the thing I like about, the black tax in general with this particular book is... really the streamlined way that you lay out what we've been missing. And I think a lot of people, you know, there's so many arguments around black people and blackness and, you know, and bootstraps and mm-hmm. what we should and shouldn't be angry about, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And this really paints a picture of, you know, really robbery via this sort of tax, via this sort of bias baked in tax. And, what is you've been traveling a bit talking about these issues.
Yep.
You know, you're on internet, you're on, you know, you got a couple YouTube albums out there. what is the response to the numbers that you rattle off here from non-black folks, white and other?
The response is typically it's always positive.
It's always positive.
Yeah, because people don't know.
They're just being nice or okay.
I'm sure there are people who are
okay,
positioning themselves
yeah.
to be vitriolic.
Right.
I'm not really running through those people because I'm not having a qualitative conversation.
Right.
I'm not really telling you about what my opinion is on the matter. I'm just sharing with you. This is different because it's a data driven, right? So it's based on data from the finest researchers and the finest institutions in the country. So if you have a problem with it, and take it up with Harvard, Stanford, Chicago, so on and so forth.
Yeah, there's reference heavy
yeah.
At the back. I mean, folks could basically get themselves a black accounting education via the papers referenced in this book. Yeah, you're right. It is lacking opinion.
Yeah.
It is, I mean, yeah, it's like a good, you know, business guy's analysis. It's like if you were looking at, if blackness was a bond of sort, you'd be looking at it from...
It's a quantification of it, right?
Yeah.
So the conversations that we have are typically qualitative,
mm-hmm.
and they're based on what people think or feel or believe about things.
Sure.
And I wasn't trying to have that kind of conversation. So we can say, well, slavery was a long time ago. Why don't you guys just get over it?
Yeah, people right? do say that.
They say it all the time.
And it takes all of me not to get angry.
They feel,
but it's fine.
Right.
Yeah.
My approach is the implication of that statement was that it was a small matter.
Right. Well,
right. And small financially. Right. So if we lose, you know, $5 and we have a, you know, net wealth, it's not that big a deal. It's still something, but it's not that big a deal. That's not going to alter, you know, our financial situation. You know, if you have, you know, $20 million and you lose 19.56, mm-hmm. that's a big deal. Right. So it implies that numerically it was a small matter.
Right.
So I said, well, let's look at it numerically.
Yeah.
Right. What was the value of the labor extracted from millions of people over a quarter of a millennia, 250 years, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Like, what do economists say that is? And they have different estimates about the ranges, and the ranges are all in the tens and tens and tens and tens of trillions of dollars.
Right.
So I look at that and I kind of average out some of those things, and it can put you very closely around $50 trillion.
Yeah, I see $50 trillion for slavery from 1619 to 1865. You've listed on page 82 of the black tax that there's about $50 trillion due. Mm-hmm. And then after that, you have a present value of black labor in 1860. So that's coming towards, you know, the end, you know, playing on the war. There's another $22 trillion right there.
Yeah. So let's talk about the $22 trillion.
Okay.
Let's give people a little bit of... So what is the black tax? Let me define that for folks, right?
Mm-hmm.
So everybody. The black tax is the financial cost of discrimination against black people driven by anti-black bias that can either be conscious or unconscious from individuals or institutions.
So black tax is the cost of bias...
Of discrimination. Which emanates from the bias.
Right. So the cost of discrimination against black people.
Yes. There is a cost to that.
Period, and then period. Based on, right.
Now, slavery is a horrifically extreme example of discrimination against black people, but it's not the only thing, right? So I'm going through all of it. It includes that. But then it also includes, you know, post-slavery. So the $22 trillion, let's talk about that.
Okay, the $22 trillion is post-1860.
Right.
Or labor at 1860 and going.
That is literally the economic value of the 4 million people who were held in bondage in 1860.
Okay, so if you had to put a price on heads and what they were producing via labor in that early industrial age, late agri age time, it's $22 trillion. Right. That's a big number.
It's a big. Let's want to talk about how I come up with that.
No, yeah, no, go. Yeah,
people,
no,
people always throw stuff out there, right?
Yeah. And so let's go into the $22 trillion again, folks. If you're just tuning in, we're talking to Sean Rochester. He wrote The Black Tax. I would look it up at blacktaxed with an ED on it, .com or anywhere on the internet. And so, we're talking about the $22 trillion that. Was the present value of black labor in 1860.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that a little bit, right? Yeah.
Because what we're setting here is the order of magnitudes, that these numbers are massive.
Mm-hmm.
So there are, if you look at what was the cost of those people, just there's many things that you could never price, by the way.
Sure.
This is just of their kind of present value.
Sure, sure.
So
well, there's a dynamism to price in general, but I like that you try to get there, period. Yeah. So yeah, right.
So economists say the value of those people is so large that you either have to measure it in terms of national wealth or national income.
Okay.
Right? So they place estimates are from a wealth standpoint, it's somewhere between 16% and 20% of total US wealth. Mm-hmm. Right? So if you put that in today's equivalent, US wealth totals about $85 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
So when you get into 16% to 20% of that, that's $14 to $17 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
So if you take an average of those things, that gets you at 15.5.
Mm-hmm.
That's one way, one mode of kind of valuing those people.
Okay.
A gargantuan number.
But
right?
Still a big number, yeah.
Right? Now if you look at it from an income standpoint, so they say the value of those people in terms of GDP, national income, is 1 to 2 years of GDP.
Okay.
So if you put that in today's equivalent, GDP, national income, is about $19 trillion, right?
Yep.
So 1 to 2 years is $19 to $38 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
If you take an average of that, you're at 28.5.
Okay.
So that's a second way of valuing them, puts you at 28.5. If you average those two, which is what I'm doing,
I'm
not even taking a high end.
Sure.
Right? If you average those two, now we're at 15. We're at the $22
trillion
that we're talking about.
Okay, so two different methods.
Yeah.
Right. To make an assumed. And again, there's a... I like that you played on that methodology, because there is this sort of cultural arbitrage that always happens with people on either side of an asset. If we're calling people, which we are in this context, an asset, where you've got people who are high and people who are low. And, you know, you usually the real market value of a thing becomes somewhere in the middle.
Right.
For folks who are thinking about it, how we engage the markets right now. So that's us post the war. You got some other interesting numbers here with regards to the Homestead Act, 1862 to 1935. What's the Homestead Act? And this is listed at another $1.6 trillion that we're missing out on, which I think the other numbers was wild. But, you know, $1.6 trillion, I think that's a number that blows people's head off. You know, people still think $100,000 is a big number these days, which is crazy.
Yeah.
So I feel like we hear the word billion so much in the news. It's like, 1,000 seems like a small
word. Let's do like a level set on numbers, right?
Okay.
So a billion, because that gets thrown around all the time now, right? Because it's normal.
Everything is billion.
Everything's $1 billion.
Right.
It's not $1 billion. It's not real money.
Yeah, I swear. And it becomes that there's a culture behind that, right? Because I was listening to someone talking about someone with, he was a centi millionaire here in the city, black man in real estate. And I know that, and I didn't say this out loud, but my knee-jerk reaction to that is, wow, that's a pretty small number. It's like $700 million. It's not a small number.
It's a gargantuan.
But media, it gears us up for, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm numb to anything less than a billion.
There we go. So a billion is 1,000 million.
1,000 million.
Right?
Yes.
So, you know, a trillion is 1,000 billion. So a trillion is a million million. So it's a... These are really gargantuan numbers, right?
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about the Homestead Act. Now, I like to juxtapose that or compare it to 40 Acres and a Mule, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the, you know, Spike Lee joint, right?
Sure, sure. Yeah,
but we all are familiar with the 40 Acres and a Mule, so I won't go into that.
Yeah.
But we know it didn't happen. Mm-hmm. But a real important question to ask is, if it had been distributed, what would that have been worth in today's equivalent?
Sure.
Right? So, you know, the idea of 40 acres and a mule is, you know, you're newly emancipated, you have land, you have a mule, which is a way to augment your labor, you can sure. produce stuff for yourself. Mm-hmm. So if you say, okay, 40 acres, 4 million slaves, that's 160 million acres.
Mm-hmm.
Gargantuan, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you look at what the price of an acre tends to be, it's somewhere between $3,020 and $6,350.
Now,
mm-hmm. right?
Okay.
Or in these last 10 years kind of time frame.
Yeah.
So, but that's, these are not Manhattan acres.
Sure.
These are not Bay Area acres. These
sure,
are farm
right.
acres. You
right.
know what I'm saying?
These are Illinois, Michigan acres, maybe.
Go, right?
Or even Arkansas acres,
yes.
which might be a little bit. right. So averaging those out, folks.
Right. So right. if you do that, on the high end, you're talking about $1 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been what newly free people would have gotten in today's equivalent just from that kind of land. That
mm-hmm.
land would be generating about $90 billion a year. That didn't happen,
mm-hmm.
right? But what did happen was this thing called the Homestead Act, which started from, like, you know, 1862, where 246 million acres were distributed to 1.5 million white families.
Right, and that's more than the 160
yeah.
some odd that you
yep.
mentioned that we would have got.
Exactly.
So we still, we had it to give. It
right.
existed.
It was given.
Sure.
Right, over a 60-year period.
Right.
Now, the $1 trillion that we think is a big number is only 2% of the $50 trillion that was extracted, by
mm.
the way, right? So not even that was allowed.
Oh, yeah, right, right. It's a small number.
Now, if you do the same math on that 246 million acres, you know, on a high end, we're talking about $1.6 trillion,
mm-hmm.
right? Now, again, this is the 1.5 million families. So that's a little over $1 million a family
mm-hmm.
that was distributed to these folks. And here's how it worked. You had the opportunity to claim up to about 160 acres.
Okay.
And if you were so fortunate as to be able to do that, if you just stayed on that land for about 5 years, after that period, you could take possession of it,
mm.
right? Now, if you were an immigrant from Europe mm. and you came to this country and you were so fortunate to be able to claim one of those parcels of 160 acres, not only would you take possession of the land after 5 years, but you would also naturalize or become a U.S. citizen, because that's how long it took back in those days,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
right? Now, but that's a $1 million equivalent
sure.
start.
And it was
right?
hard to do this. Violence, et cetera. My mind is wondering as you talk about all this. I'm thinking about Danny Glover and The Color Purple, and I shouldn't be. Anyway, keep going. Finish your thought.
Right. No. So it's
I'm thinking about the families who stayed.
Yeah. When we talk about bootstrap, I mean, it's mm-hmm. an enormous, massive government giveaway, right?
Yeah.
In today's equivalent. And when you talk about bootstrapping, I mean, that's $1 million, a hell of a bootstrap to start with.
Sure.
Right? And research says that up to 93 million white Americans are direct beneficiaries of that massive giveaway.
Sure.
Right? Not secondary, tertiary, kind of, sort of.
Right.
Like, direct.
Yeah, they work.
So
the
resources matter.
Yes.
Right? So it's important that we kind of compare apples to apples and resource to resource,
mm-hmm.
because we often don't do that when we're having conversations about, you know, kind of where Black people are.
Right.
And where other folks are.
Right.
Right? And it's just something to mention is what I try to do in the book is explain, like, how is it that after 400 years... that over, you know, 40 million Black people, right, about 45 million, only own about 2% of U.S. wealth.
Right.
Like, what does that say?
Yeah.
Right? And we need to understand how that came to be, because right now it's positioned, interpreted as Black people are there because of decisions that we've made
that we've
or
made.
Not made.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Right.
That's pretty much what it's your
That's
fault.
The conversation.
You fix the situation.
Right.
If you change you, we'll be great.
Right.
Right? And we need to have some context around that and look at things from a financial perspective.
Sure. I think the thing I appreciate most about this book is the contextualization of that. I do think too often in economic and political circles, we oversimplify our current state. And I truly believe that the real way to remedy some of the problems that we have right now is to have a more complex, more contextualized conversation about where we are. We're going to take a quick break and come back and talk about that context in a few minutes with Sean Rochester. So I'd ask everyone to stick around, and we'll be right back after this.
You're listening to WHCR 90.3 FM, the voice of Harlem. Dollar, dollar bill, yo. Cash rules everything around me. Cream, get the money. Dollar, dollar bill, yo.
If you've been listening to music for the past 30 years, and you know exactly who that was, we're back, folks, on Inclusionism with Sean Rochester. He's the author of The Black Tax. You can look up the book and buy it for everyone you know at blacktaxed.com, and give yourself some context on how we are as a people, as a country, where we are at this moment in time. So, Sherman, we were off the air. We were talking briefly about sort of the next phase. We walked through some of the numbers that you mapped out in the book, like the $50 trillion from slaves and slave labor from 1619 to 1865, another $22 trillion, which was present value of black labor in 1860, another $1.2 trillion, during the time that the Homestead Act was taking place from 1862 to 1935. And also here you have another $15 trillion separately listed from sharecropping in a Jim Crow society, which is 1870 to 1935. Tell us a bit about that $15 trillion and what that was. Is that just work on top of that land, the 40 acres and a mule, or the potential of it, or is it more? Is it something else?
So we can talk about it. It's kind of filling in the question of, like, you know, people say, listen, okay, granted, you had a traumatic period in terms of enslavement, but it stopped, right? Mm-hmm. We had a huge civil war. It stopped. And you've had 152 years. You should be good. Other people have come here.
Yeah.
They've struggled. They've gone on to do quite well. But when we look around, we see that you're in this kind of state. So it must be you.
Yeah.
And what it's important. It's important context that people need to understand. So what happened kind of post, you know, emancipation? Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have a period of kind of reconstruction that's incredibly important, very fondly remembered. But you're also dealing with the fact that the, you know, cotton was incredibly important to this country, right? 61% of all exports, right, for the whole country.
Mm-hmm.
The cotton around the world was like oil today.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. supplied 80% of that globally, right? That's coming from 4 million black people. You cannot beat free labor. No one can compete with that.
No one can compete with that.
You know, upon the Civil War, you've got a massive cotton famine around the world, right?
Sure.
That's affecting all these kind of industrialized nations. And you've got about 20 million people around the world that are employed in this industry. A million of those people lose their jobs. So it's a global issue, right? So people are kind of crying out in the middle of this cotton famine, What is America going to do to put a newly free people back to work,
mm-hmm.
right? And the idea is, you know, we need massive, cheap, readily abundant, completely subservient, right, labor, and how to be able to restore this. What are we going to do? And the issue, the solution to that becomes this kind of Jim Crow society, sure. Right? The underpinning of that is sharecropping, right? And you also have the tenant farming that goes along with it. But mm-hmm. then the idea is like, what is it? Right. And it's the Jim Crow society, a system of laws and customs reinforced with an extraordinary level of violence to reimpose 100% tax on black labor.
Yep.
Now, one of the things important to understand is that slavery, by definition, is a 100% tax on your labor. Nothing that you produce is yours.
Right.
Right. It all belongs to someone else. And you know, this sharecropping is a literal contract. Right. So these people are emancipated. They don't have resources. We just kind of talked about that. The mega plantations are broken into smaller lots. Black families kind of settle on those lots and they sign a contract to share in the crops that they produce. If they agree to produce cash crops and they'll share in a portion of that. But here's the thing. All the terms and conditions are set by the white farmer.
Yep.
Right. And we all know that you don't get crops tomorrow. You get the crops at the end of the year or the end of the season. Between now and then, that farmer has to spot you on credit all of your clothes and your room and board, the food, the tools, the fertilizer, everything that you need to produce the crop.
They own you. Yeah.
So basically, they control your full cost structure, right? Because they're setting that. And the rates are up to 70% per annum, right? It's extraordinary rates. The other piece of it is if you said, I don't want to sign that contract, well, they have laws, vagrancy laws that are waiting for you that says if you can't prove that you're a landowner and you can't prove that you're gainfully employed, that they can charge you with a criminal offense and put you in a state of county jail.
Yeah.
Right. And so there's this system that's built where it's not escapable, because if you sign a contract and you break it, now they can there's contract enforcement laws.
Right.
So they can charge you as criminal offense, put you in a state of county jail.
We would call those contracts of adhesion now. But yes, the laws still support it.
Right. Yeah, when you're in jail, they can, you know, lease you back out through convict leasing to the very white farmer you didn't want to work for or to some private corporation. So you have this complete barrier from any kind of economic, you know, opportunity. Now if you sign a contract, they control all your costs. At the end of the season, when you bring the crops to market, the white farmer's the market.
Mm-hmm.
He tells you what it's worth. So if a person controls your costs and your revenue, they control your profit by definition, right? And normally they'll make sure that your profit is negative to make sure that you don't go to someone who might be more generous.
Yep.
So you're in perpetual debt servitude. If you're in that situation and you're earning zero or negative profit, that's 100% tax on your labor.
Yep.
So you're back in a form of slavery. That's why they call it slavery by definition. Mm. Now, we got to understand this is not a 2-3 year period, right? This is 75 years.
Right.
And we know that over that period of time, 4,000 black people are executed, right, via lynching by their fellow American citizens, right, in public during that period of time. That's what we can prove and kind of document right now. We know that number is far lower than what it actually was.
Right.
For 200 years, they tried, over that period of time, they tried 200 times to pass anti-lynching laws. They didn't do it till a year and a half ago, right? Yeah. So there was no reprieve, right?
You can be executed. In the 21st century,
yeah.
a year and a half ago.
So you're under that period where you have maximum extraction of resources upon the pain of death, right? Yeah. For millions of people. Now, if you fast forward from like that, you know, that period to like 1935-ish, right? You still have almost 4 million people still in the fields working in the South,
yeah,
right? So it's extraordinarily difficult to accumulate wealth under those circumstances.
Yeah.
So if that is slavery by definition, 100% tax, right? And that's 75 years, which is about a third of the 250 years, right?
Yeah.
And they extracted about $50 trillion during that period. You can make the argument that they had the opportunity to extract another $15 trillion, about a third of that, right?
Yeah.
Now, if you start going under the detail, you'll see where the numbers start to substantiate that, right?
Yeah, folks, there's so much here. So outside of those funds, there's another, you know, in the period of the economic expansion, 1935 to 1965, which is when, you know, a lot more black folks from South Carolina or the Carolinas started to move up here to New York, where my people moved from Louisiana and Georgia up to Illinois and Michigan, and so many of us came up. to work in manufacturing and other places. There's another $4.4 trillion for labor, another $2 trillion owed from education, another $1.75 trillion from housing. In the period after that, 1960 to present, you have six decades of, you know, a persistent black and white employment gap. That's another $3.3 trillion. You've got missing integrational inheritance. Again, that's 1960 on to present day. That's another $4.2 trillion. It's just trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars extracted based on black lives, black souls being capital and having no play in the markets that we're always told are so grand and here for us to thrive. I will say I am hopeful. I do think that there are some new opportunities upon us and on the horizon, but starting from zero, or I would say
2%
below zero, yeah, at the 2% that we're at is arguably, not arguably, it's crippling. I feel the effects of it right now. It's the reason our mothers tell us we have to be 10 times as good just to sort of work really hard and die with nothing. And, you know, I'm nearly 40 and I sort of, a lot of my political drive really comes from frustration of this in general. I do want to, as I move further in the book, there's a part when we talk about purchasing power, mm-hmm. modern day, for the 2% that you're missing. So African Americans spend about 2% of the $1.2 trillion spending power on black businesses. The rest goes somewhere else. Now, there are a lot of arguments around infrastructure. Obviously, I think a lot of arguments you made shows why there's a lack of infrastructure mm-hmm. and businesses yep. that we can invest in.
Yep.
But in pivoting a bit, you and I, we were at a brunch or lunch. It was a bit heavy for brunch. There were no mimosas and omelets there. It was more like steak and beer and wine. But it was the middle of the day, and we were with a bunch of thinkers and influencers here in the city to talk about what we can do as a collective of influencers, you know, black guys here in the city. And the conversation started with, you know, just sort of brainstorming what we might do on a grand scale. And it pivoted to a bunch of micro projects, things that already exist for better or worse. And then these micro projects are bad. But let's just go into, you know, Shawnee, from your perspective, like, what can we do to become better in play right now? We got about, you know, 15 to 20 minutes left. So I want to sort of spend an exhaustive time trying to understand how we can remedy some of these ills mm-hmm. of exclusion and move forward. What do the beginning steps look like? Because I feel like we're way behind. I don't feel like, I mean, it's there. It's yep. in the data.
Yeah. So the first two parts of the book is just kind of laying out how we got here yeah. and what is still happening right here. And it's important for people to have understanding and empathy when it comes to that. Mm. Because we need to have us being interested in doing business with us and others being interested in doing business with us.
Yeah.
And if you got to deal with the fact that they don't understand why you're in this kind of ditch and mm-hmm. they feel like it's all you and has nothing to do with the environment, mm-hmm. right, then you're not going to have the type of assistance that you would otherwise have, right? If you want to... So that's the first part, empathy, understanding, so people figure out how we got here. Mm-hmm. The other piece is, what's the framework? So I wanted to talk about this framework that we can use mm-hmm. to measure the efficacy, the impact, the effectiveness of whatever the plans wind up being. And that framework is this thing I call PhD, so economic framework. So it stands for purchase, hire, and deposit in ways that create jobs, create and expand business, and provide capital in the black community.
PhD, purchase, hire, and deposit.
Yep.
It's an economic framework. Okay.
Yep. Right? So, you know, the P is really about doing business with us. So if you're a consumer, the P is our spend. That's sure. that $1.2 trillion. That's just for us, right? But then other communities have massive spending sure. levels as well, right? And are they spending any of that with us? Typically, it's extremely small amount.
Right.
If you are a business, if you are an institution, if you are a government, right, so on and so forth, mm-hmm. then that P for you is your supply chain spend, mm-hmm. right? So to deliver your products and services, you do business, you procure, you buy from a host of other businesses and then kind of transform.
That's a supply diversity industry.
Exactly, yeah. right? So Are we properly represented in that supply chain spend? Mm-hmm. Now, if you look at corporate supply chain spend with black businesses, not minority business, so I like try to be specific, sure. right? It's less than 2% of the total amount. If you look at government spend, black business, right? It's less than 2% at all levels, right? They kind of give you overall minority type levels and disadvantage levels and stuff like that. But when you kind of cull it down to black business, it's again, it's at this 2% type of level or lower. Mm. When you even look at how we spend, right? It's at the 2% level.
Yep.
So if you want to stimulate demand for our businesses, our products and services, we need to do that by doing business with our businesses, right? Mm-hmm. So when possible, where possible, let's ensure. So just let me give you a couple quick examples as individuals and then what we can do as institutions, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So as individuals, we have say over how we spend our money, right? So if you start, if you think about the fact that, you know, black folks buy and lease about 5 million cars a year. It's an enormous amount.
5 million
of,
cars?
5 million.
How many black people, what are there, 40 million of us?
45, yep.
45. Well, okay, fine. Okay, all right. I just need to digest. Yeah. It sounds like a big crazy number, but it's not that bad.
It's the number.
Yeah.
Right?
It's the number.
It's the number. It's the,
yeah.
How we feel about the numbers.
5 million. Right? 5 million Buicks and Cadillacs. I'm kidding. Yeah. Keep going. Yeah.
Right? But we're not buying them from black dealers.
Right. I only know a few black dealers.
I think the number is like 264 across the U.S.
All right. Right?
But that number should be like 2,000. I think there's 16,000 dealers.
Okay.
So it's a ridiculously small number.
Sure.
You know what I mean? These are great jobs, right? If you ever take your car in and get it fixed, you see what the rates are, right? Like there's great jobs, right? All high skilled, so on and so forth across that.
It's a good supply chain, yeah.
Just you don't need anybody's permission to choose who you're going to buy from, right?
Yeah.
And if you employ, do business with those folks, they got to hire to meet your demand.
Yeah.
It's just a very simple thing. So we can affect that. We don't need people's permission. By the way, all of those vehicles need to be insured. If you're going to drive it on public roads, you got your own farm, you just drive around there, you could self-insure.
Yep.
But you don't put it on any property outside of yours.
Gotta
it's got to be insured.
Yep.
Now, they don't tell you who you need to have insurance with, but you got to have insurance.
You're right.
Right? But who do they, are they working with a black broker?
Sure.
Are they working with a black agent?
Sure.
No.
Right.
The answer is typically no, right?
Yeah, right.
So, and those are things that we can kind of control.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in a position where, you know, you have a financial planner, who are we working with, right? Your accountant, your lawyer, like super amazing jobs, high quality, they'll never be outsourced, right?
Mm-hmm.
That are really pillars of our community. Like, we can decide to do that. And by the way, other people can decide to do that as well, because it's enormous, incredible black talent across all of those fields.
Sure,
right?
Yeah.
So if you think about that from, you know, supply chain spend, like people, think about your universities, right?
Yeah.
Wonderful institutions. A lot of the focus is on, do you have enough, you know, black representation at the student level?
Yeah.
Very important question. Do you have enough black representation at the professorial level?
Yeah.
Very important question. But for every professor, you got somewhere between 10 and 15 employees.
Mm-hmm.
No one is asking any questions about that, right? These are institutions that are multi-billion dollar institutions, massive economic institutions. They're doing a tremendous amount of business through their supply chain spend.
Oh, totally.
And all those communities, what's the black representation there?
Yeah, no, right.
Not a soul's talking about
it's
it.
Not there. Yeah,
right. Just listen carefully for what people are saying and not saying.
Yeah,
right?
And it's usually not a part of the D&I conversation. Even as I move in and out of some of those circles doing talks, the conversation is about faculty and students, not about all the auxiliary employees that make those, you know, huge, you know, microeconomies sort of thrive. They're small cities,
exactly, and the spending associated with it.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not. There are people who are willfully doing these things. They know what they're doing. There's a bunch of people for whom it's subconscious. They haven't even thought about it.
Yeah, I do think that. As I run up against a lot of folks, they're like, you know, I'm sorry. This is not something that I've considered.
Right.
Which is why this conversation has to continually, you know, happen. I hope that every 10 years you'll be able to, you know, update the text and just make sure that, again, this is something that we're constantly having. Because that is, yeah, so... So right. That is a conversation. So, right. So, back to what you were saying.
Yeah. So, those are a few. And, of course, we know about government spend, right, which is massive. If you really want to create jobs in the black community, do business with black businesses.
Totally.
You know what I mean? It's critical. And you could make a decision about, you know, procuring from products and services, and you can create 10,000, 15,000 jobs.
Yeah.
Right? Well, very often, we're looking at things from a charitable standpoint, from an optics standpoint, opposed to, listen, if you really, and I'm not saying people are kind of being nefarious, but if you really want to multiply your effect, do it through economics, job creation, business development, and providing capital in our communities. Yeah. That's going to get the maximum effect.
Yeah,
it's got to be on the table in terms of what you're trying to do. If it's not, then the efficacy of what you're trying to do is going to be highly flawed.
Oh my God, I feel like there's this movement of talking about that word capital as a dirty word. I was on a stage actually in Detroit with an activist who I love, and we were talking about people's bodies, people's data and other stuff and capital, and the whole crowd railed against me like, we need to do away with capital, period. I'm like, no matter what you call the method with which we transact value, it's still going to exist. And so after all these artists and activists sort of attacked me for using that word, not capitalism, but capital, on stage and talking about, we need a piece of this pie. Then they came back to, but we do need capital right now, though. And I think for listeners out there, and I have seen about 3 calls come in. Again, feel free to email us. We're on with Sean Rochester right now. We will be sure to, you know, share the notes that you send if there are any questions that he can answer in a more elaborate way for you. But to my point, a lot of folks are trying to move away from the thing that we actually need, that we're identifying, and you're identifying in this book, that we've been deprived of, and thinking that it can remedy all problems, when actually we should just, you know, be all screaming at once, white and black folks and everyone in between, you know, give me my money, like give me the stuff that you owe me, whether that comes through, you know, political means, economic means, and how we have the conversation or otherwise. It's slightly frustrating, I guess, is where I'm going as I'm rambling about existing in this time where people, per the data, that stuff that's put out there, stuff that you are putting out there and so many other folks are putting out there, it seems like everyone's exhausted. I was on a radio show earlier today and folks were like, we keep having this conversation over and over and over again. I'm like, well we're going to have it again because that's your life. I think we are running into this wall right now because people know things. They feel like all solutions should be on the table and we should just leapfrog the centuries of oppression that we've endured. And it's just not going to happen that way. So we do have to contextualize these arguments and we do have to move forward. Can you tell us where contextualizing how we've been deprived, where that argument is going sort of in the future, and, you know, does it at all? And if so, how does it affect the broader community, the power majority, the, you know, wealthy, straight, white man who thinks that he's losing a piece of his pie as we gain ours? Is it a zero-sum game? Is it a stagnant pie? Is it dynamic? Can it grow? You know, is this a war to take stuff out of other people's pockets, or is this you know, an opportunity to sort of increase the size of everyone's.
Yeah, so it's an opportunity that increases the size for everyone. But we also need to just talk about the facts.
Sure.
Right? The facts are, you know, white Americans own somewhere around 90%+ of all economic resources in the country.
That's crazy.
Right? So if that's not winning, I don't know what is. Like, there's the why you mad son argument,
sure.
Right?
Why you mad son.
Right?
Tell me why you mad son. Yeah.
Like, just 100%.
I wish I could pull up that sign. It curses too much.
Right, it feels different. It doesn't feel like that,
sure.
Right, for everyone, but that's what it is, right?
Right.
So how much of it do you want, right?
Sure.
So the second thing is, historically, resources have been taken out of people's pockets.
Right. They've
been taken out of black people's pockets.
Right.
Right, so if I understand the argument that people don't like that, but I'm telling you, That's your researchers from your finest universities, right? Corroborate.
Yeah.
That's been the case,
yeah.
Right? For 400 years, and that was redistributed to the benefit of people outside of black people. Minimum amounts of that went back into kind of black people. That's just the situation.
Sure.
Now, what is there to gain across the board and for everyone?
Yeah.
It's an enormous amount to gain, right? And here's let's talk about it this way. I did a talk at Google last year,
mm-hmm.
And I got asked this question. It was just like, hey, you know, you lay out this fact pattern of the cost to black people in a clear way, and I get it and I see it, but what's the cost to the country? Can you talk about that? Mm-hmm. And I couldn't talk about it at the time, and I said, I'm going to take a look at it and I'll come back to you. And I was invited back, and I was mm-hmm. able to talk to him about it. And I said, and here's what I wanted people to kind of understand, right? So that same period of Jim Crow that we're talking about, mm-hmm. That, you know, 1875 kind of period to 1945-ish, or 1945, that's also like the heart of the Industrial Revolution, mm-hmm. right? During that period of time, 2.5 million patents are created in mm-hmm. this country. Mm-hmm. You know how many came from black people on record? Mm. 726.
That's crazy. Yeah.
Right? So the question I lay out is, what if black people were allowed to fully participate in the innovation system in the country? Mm. Right? Because what you have to understand is that talent and capability follows what they call a normal distribution, which is 70% of people across all races, creeds, religion, whatever it is, 70% of people are in the middle, 15% mm-hmm. are what I call the ultra brilliant. They're significantly above average. Mm-hmm. 15% roughly are significantly below average.
Yeah.
Right? It's just across the board. If you look at what was the size of that population at 15% ultra brilliant during that period of time, mm-hmm. right? And what were they doing?
Right.
Right? So when you get into like 1870, the size of that population is about 780,000 people.
Sure.
Not the black population, just that 15%.
Right.
What are those people doing?
Right.
Sharecropping.
Yeah.
It's a massive misallocation of talent and skill and capability.
Sure.
You know what I mean? What's the size of that population in like 1900, mm-hmm. right? We're starting to keep pushing, you know, I think it's like 1.7 million people, right? And the number continues to grow up into like the 50s, right? 1948.
Yep.
1.6% of black people have college degrees. You know what I mean? So you've got this massive amount. Now, if you said, if those people have been allowed to participate in an innovation system, mm-hmm. we would have 280,000 more patents.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That would have increased GDP, national income, by another $2 trillion.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That would increase national wealth by over $9 trillion. Because what people don't realize is that what we have in creating these communities that people are in is an infrastructure for the massively underdevelopment of huge capital potential.
Yep.
Right? And being able to provide resources so those people can develop into their fullest has a massive economic benefit for the entire country, right?
Right. No, yeah, and so the pot grows. I think, folks, in contextualizing what's happening in the country, it is necessary to communicate that the pie can grow per participation. All empirical evidence suggests that. And the thing I like about your argument the most is it's hyper-based on the facts, but where it ends is that we grow via participation.
Yeah.
And this is a method to try and incentivize an argument to say we absolutely must include people in the economy as we know it in order to see it grow, see it become equitable, or we deal with these dire consequences of a lack of participation. I think that is at the heart of remedying the ills of exclusion, which is at the heart of what we call inclusionism. And that said, we gotta go. But I hope that you can come back and we can have this conversation a lot more over the course of the next few months.
Absolutely.
I'm gonna be talking about you, I think, a bit more during Black History Month. But Sean, thank you. Thanks so much for coming down here to Harlem. And everyone, check out his website, blacktaxed.com, and we'll be back here next week. Thank you.
Outstanding. Thank you so much.